eat.
Oh, so good.
Drink. Talk. Rick Redding and Steve Coombs serve up savory conversations about Louisville's world-famous restaurant food and drink scene. The wine is uncorked, the bourbon neat, the apps are on the table. Here comes the main course.
And once again, we're gathered here at the Louisville.am studios for an episode of Eat, Drink, Talk.
Fabulous, luxurious Louisville.am studio.
These are great, and if we talk real fast, maybe we'll get through it before a train goes by. But if not, you'll hear it. This show with my partner Steve Coombs, this is Rick Redding. We talk every week about some of the cool things happening in the food and dining and drinking scene in our hometown of Louisville, KY. Not LouisvilleKY.com. That's another website you can go to, but... I tell you, Steve, we've been having a good time. This is so much fun doing this kind of work, and we got to talk to some really cool people this week. Later in the show, you're going to hear from me an interview with the top dog at the Brown Hotel, Josh Bettis. Really cool guy, introduced to me by Steve, and really got a great conversation with him. Learned about the origin of the hot brown. A lot of stuff about the Brown Hotel, and your guest this week was
Joe Heron, the clever entrepreneur at Copper and King's Brandy Distillery in Butchertown. Such an amazing guy.
Bought me a meat pie and a little ice cream a week ago, so I got the pleasure of meeting Joe as well, and I'm looking forward to that interview. That's going to be a lot of fun. But we are. To use your term, Steve, we are in a spate of openings in independent restaurants.
It's crazy. I mean, I just can't believe how this keeps happening. And so many of the restaurants that land on our radar and, you know, all larger media outlets as well is East End operations. And so I'm looking at a list that came from Food and Dining Magazine editor or publisher, I should say, John Carlos White, that has all these other places that are opening up in the south end of town that, you know, we don't hear a thing about. And these are independent restaurants that are probably, I don't know, $500,000 a year businesses all on this list, and they're not even coming up to our list. And we're saying like 11 restaurants are going to open in July. There's another 10 or 15 that are out there that don't make the list. It's crazy.
Maybe, you know, we've been searching and searching on this show for a tagline. Like, you know, Rusty Satellite Show, my show is the most interesting people in the field. Maybe ours should be Eat, Drink, Talk, more reasons not to go to Applebee's.
Possibly so.
How about that?
But what if Applebee's sponsors us one day?
Well, we probably won't do
that. We'll be singing about baby back ribs.
We'll talk about Olive Garden.
Which I don't think we'll solicit their sponsorship, but that's okay.
You never know.
It's liked by millions.
Any of you out there that do want to sponsor this show, we are accepting applications to be sponsors. Seriously, we'd love to have a business come on board and spotlight themselves on Eat, Drink, Talk. It's a great website, eatdrinktalk.net, where we're reporting all sorts of great news about the dining and drinking industry. Some great stories on the site this week.
Absolutely. Not the least of which were about shocker openings. The first of which, if we go in chronological order, was at Luvino on Sunday. I went to the one in Middletown or Douglas Hills, whatever you want to call it. I call it Middletown because that's where the post office is.
And there you go. It's right there.
But this is a ground-up construction, and it's just gorgeous. The one in the Highlands that's been around for a couple of years now, I guess, was redone in the old De La Torre space, and this one they got to do from scratch. Lauren and Chad Coulter are the owners of this one as well.
And Chad, you know, was if listeners want to go back, was on our, I think, second show.
Gosh, was it that early?
It was early on, two or three, somewhere around there.
It just amazes me again that these two are pharmacists by trade and yet hit it right out of the park with their very first restaurant, and will definitely do the same in the Douglas Hills location. It's beautiful, very modern, very open cheek, and that it's running so well, or that it ran so well at the soft opening, you know, bodes well for it. That there were, I mean, the food was fantastic, the service was really good. everything hot that's supposed to be hot, everything cold supposed to be cold, et cetera, et cetera. It was great. You got to go out there. It opened officially, I think, is it tonight, maybe?
So I'm not sure, but I'm jealous. I've got a little bit piece of advice for our listeners related to that. If you ever are fortunate enough to be on the guest list and get an email invite from a place that's having a soft opening, respond immediately.
Because
I waited 24 hours and all the spots were full and I didn't get to go. So I'm going to have to go out and pay like everybody else to experience Lovino.
You know, the interesting thing about this one, and this is good for conversation, was that this was, unlike some soft openings, it was half off. Some are totally free. And I think that this is the individual restaurateur's decision to do this. And we've had some debate, at least on the media side and some of the foodie side, like you'll see it in Facebook discussions about how you're supposed to obey at a soft opening. And sometimes when it's free, completely free, the restaurateur expects the people not to take photographs, you know, that aren't flattering, not to say things online about service being slow because it is training, blah, blah, blah. It kind of buys them a little security. I think it's a fairly gutsy to go out with the 50% offer like the Coulters did, and basically said, you know, it's a discount. It's something, you know, to look forward to. It's still training, but, you know, since you're paying something, you might be able to say something online if we don't like it.
I guess they were confident enough about their product that they weren't worried about negative reviews. They sure got a nice one on eDrinkTalk.net.
Indeed, they did. It was great, and I encourage you all to go out there and give it a shot. And heck, at the very least, just look around and look at what a really well-done modern restaurant looks like.
There you
and
go.
Speaking of which,
you got to go to another cool in the 502 Bar and Bistro in Norton Commons. I'm anxious to go out there soon because they're having Homerama out there at Norton Commons. And they get like 40. They're expecting 40,000 people over a 2-week period. And
are you shopping for a new $700,000 home, Rick? Is this something I don't know about?
Well, I had an interview with Pat Durham of the Building Association, and he has a tactful way to put it. If you're not in that market right now, you know, you might still want to go out and look at the houses. So
and dream and drool and move along, huh?
And stop by at a great brand new restaurant. I guess they're opening when
officially open tonight.
Okay,
so it is on
that being Thursday. So if you're hearing
right. This,
it's this weekend. It's open.
This is on the far end of Meeting Street. So Meeting Street has been the intersection with Featherbell, I believe, where places like Commonwealth Tap are located, Karam's, Tea Station, Chinese Bistro, et cetera, et cetera. And to the right on Meeting Street, or maybe heading east, is Citizen 7. And to the far, far west is 502 Bar and Bistro. This also is a restaurant that's built from the ground up, and it's gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous.
I'm sure it's as cool. I mean, the only place that I've been to Karam's out there, I've been to Johnny Brusco's out there, which is
right. Really
a cool little Italian place.
Pizza place, yeah.
But I'm sure this is the best yet.
It is. I mean, it's when I say gorgeous, I guess everybody has their own interpretation of that. It's not some place that you're going to go look and think this was an interior decorator going mad. In fact, it's kind of the opposite. It's like the architect had.
You'll
more
see
control.
That over at the Homerama homes.
Yeah,
interior
exactly.
Decorator's gone
yeah.
mad.
I was at Homerama years ago when a little boy walked into an overly decorated room and said, "It looks like Laura Ashley threw up in here." I thought that was great. This is not what you'll see at 502. It's very sleek, concrete floors, a lot of hard surfaces, a lot of wide open sight lines, 15-foot ceilings probably, and yet, even with 150 people inside like it was the night we were there, it was not loud. It was enjoyably loud, you know, like you get that crowd buzz. It's kind of fun. Food by Ming Pu, who is a protege of Peng Lui, who is the owner of Asia Teak, did fantastic job. I mean, the food's great. Everything's in line. And the bar is abundantly stocked. It's one of the best stocked bars I've seen at a new restaurant in a long time. It's just classy casual is how I would describe it. You're not coming in runner shorts, but you don't have to wear a jacket and tie either. So it's kind of in the middle, and that makes it perfect for Norton Commons for sure.
Yeah, and you know a lot of people living out there. You know that thing is growing, and it's going to continue to grow for years and years. They get a lot of land for residential properties and. And that's going to keep happening. But, well, let's move on. I guess the big story is still you had a chance to look at this list. And tell me a little bit about this list in Food and Dining Magazine uh, of of all these, some of these unusual new places coming to town.
That's right. We'll talk about that over the rarely quiet train that just went by. You didn't hear that. The ding, ding, ding was, that was the bell of the train. You know, some of the stuff on there, like Kevin's Picnic, that Kevin Grangier's operation out in Anchorage, well, it certainly is great. Buttoned up. I mean, the guy's already proved himself with the Village Anchor and Lemu. That's to be expected out there as well. Red Hog Local Craft Butcher will be awesome. This is owned by Kit Garrett and Bob Hancock, who owned Blue Dog Bistro, which is easily one of the best restaurants in
Louisville. It's right there next to that on Frankfort Avenue, right?
A little bit further down. I mean, I would say it's a couple of blocks. This is going to be dedicated to cured meats, will be kind of the centerpiece. And Bob has been doing that for years on his own. He has hired Jay Denham of Woodland Mountain Hams to run the operation, at least the back of the house part. It's just going to be amazing. It will have a restaurant component. It will also have a butcher shop component. Hopcat next week is going to open up in the Highlands at the corner of Grinstead and Bartstown Road.
Yeah, I was understanding, you know, just based on the visuals and all that, I thought it was just going to be a place for young people to go and get drunk. But it looks like they got food, and it's a real operation.
Yeah, it's a restaurant concept. It's supposedly, I think it's 132 beers on tap. Yeah. I don't want to be the guy that manages all that.
That's what's on the billboards.
Yeah, so, somebody commented on the mention that I made of it in a story a couple of weeks ago, and I said, where all these people got to park? And the guy said, we've got parking rights at a church, you know, just down the road. Well, again, I think a block and a half walk is a long walk for people who have so many choices right there next to the road. So if he can overcome that and fill it up, because it is a big space, good on him.
And there's plenty of places to have beers along that stretch. So, it'll be interesting to see what kind of impact that has, I think.
Now you had said something about you wanted to speak on Fabaloo or Fabaloo.
Fabaloo. Well, Fabaloo, I drive by there all the time, and the other night I drove by and they had the paper down, and you could sort of see inside, and Andy Bleeden was right there riding his bike and checking it out. So I'm sure that one's getting close.
Asian concept, by the way, kind of a fusion Asian concept.
Yeah, I think people talk about what's the place in the South End that everybody likes to go through, the kitchen.
Vietnam Kitchen.
The Vietnam Kitchen. I think it's probably comparable to that, and something that will be popular, I think, right down there. It's right there on Main Street, right where the right where it starts, I guess, at the turn of
Baxter.
At Baxter, yeah.
Right, and you can go to the right and go to, is it Millwood eventually? Yeah.
Eventually Melwood. Yeah. But it basically goes down on Main Street toward the ballpark and all the stuff on Main Street. You know, we don't have this on our list, but I just read a story about a new brewery, the Old Louisville Brewery, is on Magnolia.
In 675 Old Louisville. Magnolia or something.
And so that's
opening today, right?
I think so. I think it's
business
today.
First,
and I saw that story. And, you know, we can't have too many breweries in this town. It's good to have one in that part of the city.
Absolutely.
And, you know, Old Louisville's got some stuff going for it, too.
It does. And when those businesses take the chance to move into neighborhoods like that that need some revitalization, it's a trigger. And that's great. I would love to see that area really have a regeneration. The architecture there is just amazing. It's a very walkable neighborhood. It was built to walk, clearly.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
and they changed my good friend John Gilderbloom was responsible. Some of those one-way streets have been changed to two-way. And, you know, they're just trying to manage traffic better. So, I'd say that'd be a hot spot to go to if you're in Old Louisville. It will be a really cool spot. So,
right. I'm eager to hear about Chow, that place that it's an Italian restaurant that is going in the old
Baxter Station.
Yeah, I don't know a thing about it. I don't know the operators. I've read about it. I need to just drive over and see it. It's not that far from where I live.
But yeah, maybe they need to call us and invite us over
to a soft opening.
Yeah, that would be good.
Either free 50% or 75%. We'll see.
All right. Well, let's unless you got anything else, Steve. Let's move on to our next topic because. You know, there's plenty of places to go. We've convinced you not to go to Applebee's, I guess, in this segment. But another thing about that gets a lot of attention from people and especially those in the industry, I think, is the health inspection grades. And Business First came out with a story this week that had some, what was it, 50 restaurants
that got
not A's.
Right. They did not get favorable grades on their inspections. And that's there's a lot of discussion that we've seen on Facebook this week about whether those things should be published and whether guests really understand them and the differences in ways that each inspector applies the rules. These are restaurateurs and especially kitchen employees that were talking about these kinds of things. And I don't know if it's the dirty secret that nobody wants to discuss. What's your feeling? You as a person who's never worked in a restaurant, does it? Well, you worked in a pizzeria in college, right?
Well, sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did.
What do you think when you see those scores? Does it matter to you?
Well, it doesn't really matter to me, but I'm always with a female person, you see a C on the door out there, and they're not going to want to go in.
It doesn't stand for clean.
No, it doesn't. And even B's are something that is discouraging. I can't imagine it not affecting the traffic, especially if you're getting walk-in traffic, people that can go five different places. They walk up, they see a C on the door, they're going to go keep walking.
Possibly so. Right. Even though their home refrigerator would get an E.
That's right.
You know, not even an F.
Well, you have higher expectations when you go out, I guess.
You do, and they are supposed to play by the rules. Part of the problems are a lot of rules. The other part is some of these – so if you read the Business First report, you see the reasons given for the lower grades, and sometimes you think, well, what's the big deal about that?
Yeah, it's like 42 degrees is a big deal, right?
It's a huge deal. So scientifically, that's about 41 degrees is where the bacterial party starts, and they can begin to reproduce. So they want to see chilled food below that temperature. So if it's egregiously above it, absolutely you should be in trouble. Really any above it, and so restaurateurs need to be mindful of those kinds of things. Product temperature, absolutely, but being publicly criticized for
It's like not having straws in your
exactly.
cups. Exactly.
They would
like
have an
that.
Open cup. So I guess, you know, the old concerns about washback in a bottle or your cup, and you could spill it over into food. Well, the problem is solved by throwing the food away. That's one way to do it. But people smoking on the line, not excusable. But I can remember being the last time that I got inspected as a chef and got a 94. I remember thinking, man, you didn't look very hard. The things that were taken off on my report were minimal compared to some of the stuff that I knew that they could have looked at. So I don't think they have enough time to be thorough. Mm-hmm. And perhaps every restaurant could be shut down when thoroughly inspected.
Maybe you know this. I don't. How often does a typical restaurant get inspected? Is it
annually?
Annually,
yeah. Sometimes twice a year if they have a poor record of sanitation. So.
There must be a lot of inspectors. It would take a while to get around. I mean, when you start looking at this and doing this thing, the number of places that need to be inspected, there's just probably thousands.
Right. I think there is it 1,700 restaurants in Louisville? I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And once you go into a restaurant, that there must be a couple of hundred points that could be checked, literally. So it is for our public's health, and it's important. I sometimes think that the scarlet letter, be it BC or I don't know if they have an F or not.
I think that's shut down.
Yeah, they just paint over the door. It doesn't seem like there's a process that happens fast enough to where they can fix the mistake, because usually the things can be fixed right then and there. If you've got a refrigeration issue and you're 10 degrees warm, you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. Shut her down. I mean, and they should do that, because if it's just if that's really the issue, shut it down. But if you got violations like somebody with an open container, you know, drinking on the line, you know, water. We're not talking booze. Big deal. You can fix that quickly.
Right. Right. All right. Well, let's move on to one of our parts of the show that's becoming a quick favorite. Now, I'm a total failure on this week. I'm hoping to get my fix of favorite eats and favorite drinks tonight, Thursday night.
Oh my gosh, you're going to be blown away.
To go to see Josh Bettis, and he's introducing it. You'll hear in the interview later in the show, the chef's table, that a very exclusive group going to tonight. I expect to be able to report to you something favorite next week. But
while you're at the chef's table tonight, I'm going to be eating stadium steaks over at the Bats game. So I'm excited for you, because you've not gotten to have this experience, have you, where you're directly in the kitchen, and it's great. You're going to be blown away at how much fun this is.
Well, I can't wait. But you did have some good experiences. What was your favorite food of the week?
My favorite bite was the grilled Berkshire pork chop at the 502 Bar and Bistro. It was just amazingly tender, very flavorful, thick, must have been an inch and a half thick, served with an apple and fig port reduction. It was absolutely delicious. Perfectly cooked. Way to go, Chef Ming Poo.
What is that sous vide cook?
Sous vide means...
throwing French on me.
It is. You're correct. It means under vacuum. So what they do is they'll take the pork chop, and it'll be vacuum sealed, and they'll put it in a water bath of about 140 degrees and hold it there for a very long time. And what that does is slowly breaks, the heat breaks down the collagens that are the connective tissues within protein.
Okay.
And you don't want to cook the meat so much as you want to break that down and make it tender. So once it's pulled out of that water, then you can sear it on the grill real fast and send it out. So it's a rapid cooking technique, also a tenderizing technique. And whenever you see sous vide on a menu, get excited. That's okay. Going to be good.
I'll be looking for that. Now, you had some beer at Knock Bar.
Oh, man. The Obsidian Stout. It is Obsidian is the brewery, and their stout was pushed on nitro. If beer drinkers listening to this like that kind of stuff, I do. It gives it a really creamy texture. It's a little teeny weeny bubble as opposed to a carbon dioxide bubble. And it just feels almost like chocolate milk going over your tongue. Fantastic. Mm. It was at Knock Bar. Knock Bar is awesome. If you've never been there and want a great corner bar experience that's kind of maybe tuned a little bit toward millennials, I still fit in. I'm almost 52.
Well, you think you fit in.
I think I fit in. Maybe I just missed their scornful, you know, gaze.
Who's that old guy over there?
Yeah, look, can I help him out? Can I wheel him out?
But need some help, sir? You know, when they start calling you sir, it's trouble.
No. But anyway, if you want to pay my tab, go ahead. You know, mistake me for a veteran?
Yeah,
no.
That could be help. So
so that was great. Right.
Well, we're going to wrap it up here, but first I want to talk about there's some cool things going on this weekend. I don't know what you got on your schedule, Steve, but...
Zero, and I'm excited about it.
All right. Well, you can join me, if you'd like, at the Blues, Brews, and Barbecue Festival down on the Water Tower.
Yeah, that's
right.
We're
going to go down there and sweat like you're going to do at the baseball game tonight in the heat. But they have this every year at the Water Tower. It's a lot of fun, and I'm going to make an effort to go hungry and try some of the barbecue.
I'm sure it'll be great.
It'll be great down there. And if you don't know, I just learned about this yesterday from an interview I did for the Rusty Satellite Show. The Homerama thing that's going on at Norton Commons should be great. Maybe I'll stop in at the 502 bar afterwards. But, you know, I talked them into some free tickets for going out there, so I'm looking forward to
nice.
Seeing some things I can't afford in housing.
And your lady friend will enjoy it, get some ideas.
That's right.
Right?
That's what it's
all
about.
Because I know you ain't decorating at home. Nor am I.
I am not. So anyway, so that's what's going on this weekend. We've had a great week, and I think we're about ready to go into the interview portion of our show. I think you're going to enjoy our guest, Josh Bettis, and Joe Heron, who are just really, I guess if we say what's common about them, they're great leaders and they're great innovators in the industry.
And if you are a budding entrepreneur or a successful entrepreneur, you definitely want to tune in to listen to Joe's theory about building business. He's just a fantastic guy. So anyway, Josh is awesome too.
Head coach of the Western Kentucky Hilltoppers, Jeff Rom.
Today I'm with Matt Jones,
Kevin Harned,
Pat Forty.
But I'm with Anoush Sheriott,
Kristen Wall,
United States Congressman John Yarmuth,
Sarah Brofancher, and Susie Eastman.
I have Kristen Boone,
one of St. Matthew's most favorite sons, Danny Flanagan.
It's Pat Day.
The list goes on and on. The most interesting people in the Ville are on the Rusty Satellite Show with Rick Redding. New episodes Thursdays on Louisville.am.
My guest this week is Joe Heron, entrepreneur extraordinaire and co-founder of Copper and Kings Brandy, American Brandy Distillery in Butchertown. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Semi-professional drinker.
Semi-professional drinker to add to his resume. You're only semi?
And athlete.
I thought you were a pro.
No, you can't be a pro. That's a different kind of commitment. I like the social side of it.
Me too. So I guess that makes me semi-professional because I only drink in a social setting. Now, for listeners who might not be familiar with your story, give us a brief background on how you started, how it came from South America, how you came from South America through Europe to the United States and down to little old Louisville.
From South Africa.
South America. I knew I was going to... I even said it in my notes. I've got notes here, people. South Africa.
So from South Africa via England, Sweden, Minnesota to Louisville. Actually, we've been working in Louisville for a long time. We started a soda company with our friend Dave Defoe at Flavor Man in 2003. Right. And so we've been working in Louisville for 13 odd years now. And then we did a cider company and again worked with Dave. And then had this idea of, reinvigorating the brandy category along an American paradigm as opposed to a traditional European paradigm. And we wanted to anchor ourselves in American distilling, and what better place to be than Louisville. And so that's how we got to Louisville. And then Leslie found us our beautiful building in Butchertown. It wasn't very beautiful when she found it. But
Leslie is his wife.
Yeah. So Les is the brains in the operation and the beauty. So I'm not left with much.
This is why we chose you for a podcast.
So she's brains and beauty and I'm bloody mindedness. So that's kind of what it takes.
But talk a little bit about, because I want to give people a context for the way you think. Talk a little bit about Nutrisoda, which was the soda company that you came here for, and the idea for it. And because I want people to grasp a little bit of your creative mind in that sense. How did you think that up?
So we were, over drinking together, me and Les. So that's when our best ideas come, is having a drink together, hanging out.
Semi-professional drink.
Yeah, semi-professional social drinker. and the business philosophy is actually more specific than people realize. We are very interested in the next big thing rather than the current big thing. We're more interested in vacant space than crowded space. We're interested in developing categories that can become defined by our brand as opposed to another brand. So when we did Nutrisoda, everybody was doing energy drinks, and we did drinks that boosted your immunity and your mental alertness and even your joints.
Which drew on your fatigue from traveling a lot, right?
Yeah. I was a corporate executive with Novartis. A lot of traveling, a lot of the stresses of perpetual meetings and conference calls and things like that. And so that's where Nutrisoda came out. We would do nutrient-enhanced sodas that would actually have functional levels of nutrients as opposed to just monkey dust marketing. And so Pepsi America's bought that in 2006, and I worked there for 2 years. And then we had the idea of getting into the hard cider category, which again was quite moribund with just two or three brands made from fermented
apple
juice,
right?
Well, not really from fermented apple juice concentrate. And we wanted to reinvent that with an adult context and not sweet profile made from fresh pressed juice. And that was the space, and that's where Crispin came from. So you can hear the story is about we're interested in being more definitive than derivative. We're interested in adding, elements versus subtracting elements. So when we look at a business opportunity, we always think about, all right, how crowded is it? That's important. And that's what we call the well-served side of it. But we look at the served well side of it, which is about what's missing? What can you add value to? What can get you premiumization in terms of image, pricing? And that tends to revolve around intrinsics. And those things. What are the ingredients that go into things? What's the packaging look like? And those, and we wouldn't do bourbon. It's very well served, lots of brands, and it's served very well. We think that Kentucky bourbon's great. And, who's going to who's going to argue with that point.
How did you guys settle on brandy? I mean, was this something that you learned to appreciate when you were in South Africa and again, traveling and living some in Europe as well?
Well, actually, so South Africa has a very proud brandy tradition. It started in 1672, which, by the way, is 32 years after the USA first distilled brandy. It was actually not the USA. It was the Dutch colony of New Netherlands. So brandy was first distilled in America in 1640, mm-hmm. okay, and then got lost during, you know, the Civil War and Prohibition, and those things decimated the essentially small batch, small scale type of production that you had for brandy. So was I a brandy drinker? No, not really. I've always been more of a whiskey drinker. I mean, I'm pretty agnostic about good booze.
Uh-huh.
So I am more interested in a more feisty, spicy tonality than I am for a very even keeled nature of a spirit. So when you look at brandy, brandy's signature is length and finish and what people would summarize as smoothness. And that can be translated, say, in cognac or South African brandy, more traditional styles, is, to me, lacking in the personality and character that I like in whiskey in particular. So when we looked at what our style would be as a brandy, we were looking at a house style of something more feisty, more rambunctious than a typical cognac or South African brandy or Spanish brandy. We're looking for rock and roll brandy.
And are these characteristics gained at the still, in the barrel?
They gained everything. So we have some big advantages, which are not unique to us, but they're differentiated from France in that we can distill any grapes that we want, and which means we can choose highly aromatic, highly acidic grapes with, you know, essential personality at the beginning, whereas Uni Blanc, say, for cognac, is a very bland wine. It's essentially made for distillation. So, yes, but where it comes in is we have Vendome pot stills, and so the process of brandy distillation is about retention and concentration. And you can contrast that with whiskey, and as you know, I like whiskey, but it's not a contrast versus a comparison. Whiskey is about extraction and purification to palatability. You punch mm-hmm. the proof levels to get to better palatability. We don't do that. We're retaining and concentrating. And then we have pot stills, which are more about, say, intensity, versus a column still, which is more about efficiency. So when you look at our process about intensity, retention, concentration, you're trying to keep everything in. We don't.
And texture as well, right, from the pot still.
Feel. So we only
get much more contact with the copper that way.
Yeah, and we only distill twice, so we don't distill multiple times. So you're keeping everything in. That leaves a lot of oils within the distillate. But then when it comes to maturation is where you start to see more of our profile, and so we double distill, as I say. So you're not distilling the essence of the fruit out, you're keeping it in. We age in Kentucky bourbon barrels. We enter the barrel at 135, which is straight off the still, which is a little different to bourbon, which will be ranged from 125 to 110, say, for makers.
Weeded style. Lowest 103 at Michter's. That's about the lowest I've seen.
That's the lowest I know of, and it's not common, and it gives them their house style. But that dilution from 155 off the still with Kentucky limestone water to 125, 110, 103, we don't dilute. So we go into the barrel at 135. It's a little higher, which means we extract as much of that bourbon note and that as we can. We're trying,
because you're using a used barrel.
We use used barrels, and I can wax lyrical about why we believe American oak is the perfect medium for aging brandy, because of its structure. It gives you caramel, honey, vanilla tones that we think that warmth and that richness is very appropriate for a brandy.
But that's a whole different discussion. Complementary. As well.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we go in. If we're all familiar, especially in Kentucky, about the angel share and evaporation. In Europe, it's it's commonplace to top up your barrel during maturation as it evaporates. So you're adding water. We don't do that. So there's no top up process. We don't add any essences post distillation, like boise is oak flavor, oak essence. We don't add any apple essences or flavors to our apple brandy.
And you're allowed to do that to brandy, but not cognac. You can in cognac as well?
Absolutely.
Oh, I didn't know you could add essence.
It's very, very common to add boise, which is oak essence. I mean, that's normal. And we don't do that. So we don't do anything post-distillation in terms of addition. No caramel color, things like that. So very much a bourbon process. And now you're starting, without that adulteration, you're starting to get a much more authentic, natural flavor and color that comes off.
And what do you mean by authentic? Like it was done in days of yore, I guess? Or?
No, I mean that it's reflected of the distillate and the spirit and the wine that preceded it versus something that's manufactured and managed to consistency and predictability. We don't do that, which is beautiful. You and I know each other quite well, so consistency and predictability are not in my personality, certainly. But and then we don't chill filter, which is another way that you manage predictability. So having started with great wine, unfiltered, unsulfided, distilling it on Vendome stills, aging in bourbon barrels, new American oak, and then letting the barrel do the work, and then not chill filtering and adulterating with post-distillation additives, that gives you your style. Now you're managing it. You'll never, the cheetah's smoothness and length of finish, but the mid-palate bite and spice and character, that's unique to us in terms of brandy. And that's our house style. That's what we're trying to do.
Now, speaking of unpredictability, maybe from the consumer side we would call it unpredictability, and from your side you see it as just tapping into this creative body of knowledge here with the staff. Wait, is it 2 years old now or 3 years?
We're 2 years old. We started distilling just about 2 years ago.
So you have multiple lines of brandy, gin, absinthe. You've got a line of sodas. And today, if you hear any background noise, folks, they're putting together a party. They're really going to do a soft opening to taste their handheld meat pies. This is at a distillery. So what? Explain how so much creativity comes from such a small company.
You know, I think it's easier for small companies to be creative. You know, the Brownian motion is of the collision of ideas is more manageable. The risk level is lower. And then I think it's just us. It's our personality. We like doing stuff. We like celebrating the Butchertown neighborhood in particular, Louisville, overall. We want the experience of the Copper and Kings distillery to be dynamic but also unique and unusual. It's because there's a lot of distilleries to visit and more every day. So when you come here, we want you to say, you know, the pies are different or the sodas are different and, you know, things like that. But also, and this is something I've spoken to you about from the very first time we met, we were very interested in Copper and Kings being a community asset more than a tourist attraction, where people from Louisville and the surrounds would come in to be at Copper and Kings. And now we're starting to see the genesis and emergence of something quite substantial with the passing of SB 11 legislation with
right.
The Kentucky laws have changed, so we can start to provide a more rounded experience where you can enjoy cocktails and alcohol by the drink. And so now
on site right
upstairs on the sky deck, say in the ampersand bar or down in the courtyard, and now it's becoming something fun. But I would say that the idea flow, hey, maybe it's because we're in the booze business and there's lubrication, I don't know. we know how to grease the skids. It is an enormous fun, and if you can have the sun shine on your face through, you know, people having fun and fulfilling themselves, that's pretty rewarding.
Well, on that note, we'll go ahead and close out, and we're going to go try some meat pies, aren't we?
I'm greasing
the skids.
Starving.
Along with Butchertown sodas. It's 11 o'clock or 11:30. Yeah, we won't be drinking just yet.
Yeah.
Even in an amateur status.
I think it's a little early. A little early on a Wednesday, on a Thursday.
Joe Heron, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Steve.
Excuse me, garçon. I'll have another.
All right, today I'm in the wonderful lobby bar at the Brown Hotel with Chef Josh Bettis. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
We're very excited about it. You know, you've been here almost 3 years, you told me, and you seem to be getting settled in after a career globetrotting, basically, right?
Well, yeah, I've been kicked around quite a bit, but, you know, on my own accord, I wanted to be. That's where you learn. I think, you get in there and roll up your sleeves and go from East Coast, West Coast, do a little time in Europe and get knocked around, pick yourself up, dust yourself up, and get going. Like I said, I've been here for just under 3 years. I've been here about 2 years and 8 months now.
Okay. Okay, so for our listeners that don't know, what all are you in charge of down here at the Brown?
I'm in charge of wherever there's food and beverage. So from, the 24-hour in-room dining, which is room service, to the cafe downstairs, which is full a la carte breakfast and lunch, and then breakfast buffets on Saturday, a beautiful brunch on Sunday. I'm in charge of the 4 Diamond Award-winning English Grill. I'm in charge of the lobby bar, the beautiful lobby bar in which we're sitting in now. Wherever there's food and beverage, I'm in charge of it. I also run all the stewards, the stewarding department, as well as I oversee all the receiving and purchasing for the hotel.
Wow. I'm tired just thinking about all that. That's a lot. So you've been here 2 years, 8 months,
yep.
As you say.
Yep.
What changes have you implemented? I mean, how have you... what changes, if any, have you made to make it your signature?
You know, like I said, I do a little globetrotting. I've been to hotels and resorts, East Coast, West Coast, United States, Europe, like we talked about already. And, you know, you take some of all of the fundamental things that you learn throughout your travels, and you try to incorporate them into the most current hotel you're in. Now, are those things always going to work? Of course not. Every hotel, every resort is very unique. Anyone I've been in the world, it's unique to its own and to its own business venture. And what works for this hotel may not work for the hotel, say, just 30 miles up the road. It's all about your clientele. It's about learning your surroundings, learning your city and you know, your atmosphere. But the big thing is making friends and learning about people, and that's why I like the globetrot, because it's a fantastic job. You know, food speaks every language. You know, it's an easy transition. I could be in a kitchen with not English speaking chefs, and you look at them and they see what you're doing, and you see what they're doing, you meet in the middle and you get an idea, and you know, so things work usually pretty much for the chef. You know, it's a lot of hard work. But you get to know your property, you get to know the clientele, and you get to see what works, you get to see what doesn't work. Some of it's trial and error. Hopefully you don't have too many errors, because it does cost money. This is a business. But, you know, you see what's going on, but then you also have to put on your own uniqueness. I think what we do here is unique to the area. It's not the cookie cutter everyone's menus look the same, and ours are a little bit different. You know, we do a little more venturing into the English Grill, and you put your mind and your education and your past experiences together. You put a little bit of your heart and soul and yourself into it, your own personality, and it hopefully comes out to be a great little statue of what you want to mold.
Well, great. Now we're doing something special Thursday night. Unfortunately, be invited. This will air after that, but. Tell me what's going to happen Thursday night, what I can look forward to.
Well, I'm not going to say any of the press people's names who's invited. We've got quite a few A-list press folks, and we're going to do a chef's table. There's about 10 or 12 of us, and we're going to be introducing the new chef cuisine of the English Grill, Andrew Wellenkin, who's got a very, very big and great reputation, great name in the city of Louisville. Everybody knows him from Bucks and his last venture at the Goat, helping out a little bit. We're also going to be introducing the semi-new general manager, Troy Ritchie, He's got a very good name, very, very versed and educated in wines, and most people will know him from the 20-plus years that he spent with Dean over at Corbett's, and we're excited to have that little duo together, and we're going to make some great things happen. So we're going to introduce them and roll them out, and we're going to do it properly. We're going to do it with the nice chef's table back in the kitchen, and we're going to wine them and dine them, show them what we can do, and reintroduce Troy and Andrew as running the English Grill.
Very good, very good. Well, I'm certainly looking forward to it. Should be a great event. And let's talk a little bit about the brown here, because I mean it's all about tradition here, right?
It is, you know, and that's what's great about it. I love the story of why the Brown Hotel was built. And, you know, it was built back in 1923 by Mr. Brown, and you know, he'd gone down to he was an industrialist and was a logger, and he was very much hands on, and he would get in the pits with the guys, man, and he would go and, you know, wear his overalls and we'd go ahead and, you know, get in there and decide he's going to take his boys out for a nice drink. Brought him down to the seal box. They denied him service by what his attire was. Said, no, I don't think you're coming in here. He said, well, I'm going to open my own hotel and put you out of business. And, you know, so 10 months, $4 million later, the historic, beautiful Brown Hotel was built. And we weren't successful in putting the seal box out of business. Obviously, they're still up there, standing well. So... But, you know, the history here is great, and you say getting back to the bosom of what we are, that's what we're going to do in the English Grill. So our motto is, it's kind of, we're going on the lines of, you know, everybody wants to go forward. You know, the new buzzwords is new hotels, new restaurants popping up everywhere, new chefs. What are we going to do? I said, we're not going to compete with them. We're going to go the other way. They want to go this way. We're going to go backwards. So we're going to go back in time. We're going to get back to the bosom with the grandeur of the Brown Hotel is. We've established our footprint since 1923. We're obviously doing something right. So, but we're going to get back to that and celebrate that. We're going to simplify cooking. We're going to do a lot more tableside service. We're going to use just the highest possible ingredients that we can get, all locally. And we're just going to do a nice classic technique and get back to the roots of what the Brown Hotel is.
Okay, so let's elaborate on that, the part about local food a little bit. Because a place like this, how do you source a local food, and how much of it are you able to serve?
Well, I mean, being in Kentucky, it's a great thing, obviously, with all the produce and all the farms and everybody we have in Kentucky Proud. Boy, what a drive that is. And, you know, Mayor Fisher with his drive for bourbon and his drive for celebrating the arts of food, if you will. And so he's been a big supporter of all that. So we want to get back to where we are. And you know, we use the Kentucky Proud products. We use local farms. I'm a big fan of a farmer in town named Mac. Not going to say his last name. I don't want anybody to take his business, but, you know.
Don't be knocking on his door.
He only has so much room in his greenhouse, and I want as much of it as I can. But he's in charge of Groganica Farms, which he does things aquaponically. So everything that started out is seedlings underwater, and it's all fertilized by koi fish. So it's, you know, when they say organic, they're allowed to have so much chemical in a product and still be considered organic. This has absolutely none. It's all done by koi fish.
Wow.
So there's all these different beautiful farms and products in Kentucky, and that was one of the draws for me to come to Louisville after traveling around, is just seeing the farmland and seeing the availability of local products. It's wonderful.
It's outstanding. All right, well, before I let you go, I want to ask you about your most famous thing here on the menu, the hot brown. You knew what it was before you got here?
I did. When somebody says, you know, the historic Brown Hotel in Louisville, Kentucky, you know, I think just growing up in kitchens and hotels and everything, you know, certain things ding in your head, and the hot brown was certainly one of them. And you know, when I first got here, that was one of the big buzz questions by all media, you know, asking me, so chef, you know, are you going to change the hot brown? And I must have looked like a deer in headlights and says, geez, no, I don't want, you know, torches and you know, people knocking down the doors, and I'd be run out of town. So, you know, we just came, you know, we're in our 90th year for the hot brown and celebration of
it.
So 90 years, and here we are talking about it still. I get more media about that than anything else. They don't want to come and see me. They want to see the sandwich, man.
So they don't. So you didn't change it a bit. I mean, is it the same recipe it was 90 years ago?
It is, yeah. Wow. It's the same. We haven't wavered from it. It's just such a iconic dish, obviously, not just in the United States, but worldwide.
Yeah.
You know, our last chef that was in the English Grill, Ryan O'Driscoll, he went back to Australia now. He was moved on, but, you know, he went home, and lo and behold, you know, he emails me and says, I can't run away. I can't get away from the Hop Round because here I am back in Australia. And he goes to a local eatery, and there's a Hop Round on the menu. So it's worldwide, and I do, you know, a lot of national press about it. And, you know, it's just a great thing. It's got a great history. If you haven't heard the history of the Hop Round, and I know we don't have time to go through it, but read up on it, look at it, shoot me an email. I'll send it to you. It's just a great little history.
Yeah, it sounds very interesting. I guess I'm going to have to look it up. I don't know the whole history of the dish, but I guess you still must have a lot of people who think that's what they have to order when they come here, right?
Yeah, we get people from, you know, like I said, from all over, all walks of life, and young and old. And, you know, the thing about it is, as I said, it's an international dish. And that's true, because people will come from all over and in different countries, and they'll come here and say they have to have a Hop Round. But it's not just out of town. People say, okay, but what about the out of towners? What do they think? Are they kind of tired of hearing about the Hop Round? And they're not, because we'll have grandmothers, great grandmothers bring their great grandchildren and people that come here and they've been living here all their lives, generation after generation, and still come to the Brown Hotel, and they have to come down and they have to come and get a Hop Round.
Okay. Well, this is my last question, I promise. What's the second most traditional thing about the service here at the Brown?
You know what? I just think the whole atmosphere, the ambiance, the true Southern, you know, hospitality that we offer, just the way that the staff is trained, the way that we treat our guests, and it's second to none. It certainly stands out from any place I've ever worked in, and I've worked in a lot of places, as you've said. But I mean, if you mentioned earlier in the interview, we're sitting in the lobby bar. I mean, if you look around the second story lobby bar, it's just so majestic, and there's just so much history. I just think that, you know, the history alone itself, and then the elegance of our service, I think it's just second to none.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you again Thursday night, and thanks for being on Eat, Drink, Talk.
Hey, it's my pleasure. We'll see you on Thursday.
If you just can't get enough, catch up on the news of the city's restaurant scene every single day by visiting www.eatdrinktalk.net. Steve and Rick share all the latest local scoop from Louisville's restaurants and bars. You can also find old episodes of the show and connect with the guys on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Eat well, my friends. Another episode next week.